Track 13. Towering above the bloody chaos at the siege of Rorke's Drift, immortalised in the film Zulu, was the figure of a Norfolk-born chaplain. Chris Armstrong looks at this extraordinary life.
George Smith started life in the West Norfolk village of Docking, where his father was the village shoemaker. Born on January the 7th, 1845, he was baptised the following day, a practice normally adopted only in cases where there was concern as to the health of the child and some doubt as to whether he would live. Such considerations did not long remain an issue here. George Smith grew to be well over 6 feet tall at a time when the average height was about 5 foot 5 inches and of fairly stocky build. With a huge red beard and dressed in a frock coat, sometimes tinged with mildew, he became the very model of the kind of muscular Christianity which characterized missionaries in the Dark Continent, as Africa was known at the time. And that is what he became, traveling to Africa originally as a lay missionary after training in Kent, for the Society for the Propagation of the Gospel in Foreign Parts, the SPG. Later, he was ordained in Africa by Bishop Colenso, himself a former Norfolk parson. But their Norfolk background was just about all that they had in common, apart from their faith. Colenso was very much of the Low Church party and emphasized equality regardless of race or religion, while Smith, of the High Church party, saw his role as the conversion of Zulus to the Christian faith. In time, Smith became the rector of Estcourt, a parish in what is now known as KwaZulu-Natal, where something like half of the European population were Boers, and the huge majority of the total population were Zulu. There he built a church, but funds were short, and the bell tower had no bells, and the windows no glass. Times were threatening, and the spectre of a Zulu uprising pervaded all aspects of life for the Europeans. Smith's church might have had no bells, but it had plenty of bullets. It was used as an ammunition store as well as a place of worship. In the event of a Zulu attack, the church was designated as the refuge for the women and children of the settlers, who would be defended by a laager of wagons surrounding the church from behind which the menfolk would seek to beat off the Zulus. As a last resort, the men would finally retreat into the church for a last stand if things went badly. Smith, described by Donald Morris in his book The Washing of the Spears, as a fire-eater, was clearly a man up for a fight. His reports to the SPG were full of daring rides through threatening scenes and stays at bolted and barricaded settlements, and he was on the periphery of military action on a number of occasions. When the British Army, under Lord Chelmsford, went to search out the Zulus, George Smith volunteered to go as a chaplain. At this stage, he remained a civilian. Chelmsford split his force, leaving about 1,200 troops at Isandlwana. The troops there took very limited measures to protect themselves and paid a huge price. Attacked by a large Zulu force, they were virtually annihilated in perhaps the most embarrassing defeat of the imperial era. Only about 60 members of the force escaped, and the film Zulu opens with the pursuit of Lieutenants Melville and Coghill as they seek, unsuccessfully, to save the regimental colours. Padre George Smith conducted the funerals of them both a few days later. The courage of the two men was recognised when they became the first two people ever to be awarded the Victoria Cross posthumously. The film is primarily about what happened next, the attack on Rorke's Drift, a mission station in use as a military hospital, where about 150 British soldiers, perhaps a quarter of whom were already ill or wounded, successfully fought off an overnight attack by 4,000 Zulus. The film was a huge success, but sadly some aspects of it were a little economical with the truth. One serious omission is the role of George Smith, who, although a key figure in the action, is completely ignored. Based at Rorke's Drift, Smith was involved from the start. He was perhaps the first to realise that an attack was imminent. Hearing the sounds of battle at Isandlwana, 6 miles away, he and a few others had ridden to the top of a neighbouring hill to try and make out what was happening. Smith took a telescope with him and although the landscape prevented a clear view of the battle site, he was able to discern a group of riders leaving the site and heading towards them. At first, these were assumed to be members of the Natal native contingent, but as they came closer, it became obvious that they were Zulus, mounted on captured horses, and Smith's party galloped back down to Rorke's Drift to alert the defenders. Most non-combatants took flight for safety, and some accounts suggest that Smith might have done the same had he not discovered that both his horse and his bearer had disappeared, presumably together. Whether he stayed because he had no option, or out of a sense of duty, doesn't alter the fact that his contribution to the defence of the station was exceptional and brave. These defences, hastily put together using biscuit tins and mealie sacks, had to cope with attacks from all sides at once, and the situation became chaotic, especially after the hospital was set alight, and the patients, with Zulus literally climbing into their rooms, struggled to find cover behind the makeshift barricades. Throughout the siege, which lasted more than 12 hours from 4 p.m. until about 4:30 a.m., George Smith strode about the compound, a towering figure in a white solar tope and frock coat, carrying a haversack regularly restocked with ammunition, which he distributed to the defenders in small clips. His size, his dress, and his role must have made him an obvious target, but he seems to have led a charmed life and escaped unhurt. Paintings of the battle, especially that of the artist de Neuville, showed him in action. Without his efforts, men who could ill be spared would have had to dash back to claim ammunition for their sections, otherwise they would have been overrun when the ammunition gave out. As he delivered the ammunition, Smith was full of advice, reminding his men to shoot low and admonishing any soldier who swore. One defender reportedly told Smith to get on with the praying while I send the bees to hell as fast as I can. As daylight arrived, the Zulus, seeing in the distance a British relief column, fled, leaving behind hordes of dead and wounded. Smith recorded in his recollections that over 100 muskets and 400 assegais were recovered from the scene. The successful defence of Rorke's Drift was a remarkable feat of arms and courage. No less than 11 Victoria Crosses were awarded during the siege, an extraordinary proportion of the men involved. Some felt the number was excessive and a reflection of a desire on the part of the government to brush the memory of Isandlwana out of the public consciousness, but to be outnumbered roughly 40-1 in a night attack immediately after an ignominious defeat the previous day must have called for a special brand of courage. George Smith was not among those decorated. As a civilian, he would not have qualified. But a story circulated that he had been offered a choice between a decoration and a career in the army, and chose the latter. Whatever the truth of the tale, he did become a full-time chaplain shortly afterwards. Rorke's Drift had clearly not put him off the military life. One contemporary officer said he was as keen on the fight as the best of us, and Morris described him as having an unquenchable enthusiasm for military life. His later military exploits included the Sudan campaign against the Mahdi in 1884. In retirement, Smith, who never married, travelled widely and saw for the first time in the Art Gallery of New South Wales the de Neuville painting which featured him so prominently. The director of the gallery recorded that Smith was visibly moved by the reminder of that night and the death of so many colleagues. He seems to have enjoyed a special place in Australian hearts. When he died in 1918, the Australian press published lengthy obituaries, while The Times was relatively brief. Perhaps the Great War, which had ended just a few weeks earlier, placed the gallantry of Rorke's Drift in a different perspective. When not travelling, Smith spent his retirement in a hotel near Preston, which had been his last posting. But even after his death, his spirit lived on. The hotel had been demolished and rebuilt, but as recently as the 1980s, staff consulted a medium because they were convinced the ghost of Smith rang the bell in the bar and left empty beer bottles in the fridge. George Smith was a true Norfolk-born hero, much loved by the troops. He was known to them as Daddy Smith, but after Rourke's drift, he became known instead as Ammunition Smith. Rarely was a nickname better earned.